So it's always a little awkward at first, but I genuinely enjoy recording episodes on books I don't like. And Franny and Zooey is one of those books. I read it once in high school and then read it once again for the show. And I wouldn't say it's just a book I enjoy, and we'll discuss it as we go. But I like these episodes a lot because I always inevitably learn so much more from my guest that even if I don't end up loving a book that we talk about, I always genuinely gain an appreciation for it. So with that, please welcome our guest, Adam Levin, and welcome to Your Favorite Book. All right, so Adam, thank you for joining me today. I hope you're doing well.
I am, thank you. Thanks for having me, Malika.
Let's just jump right into this. So you've got a book coming out, not your first rodeo in the world of book publishing, but can you tell us a little bit about, you know, yourself, your work, and about this book in particular?
Sure, I can try. I'm from Chicago. I lived there most of my life, and now I live in Florida because my wife, who's also a novelist, Camille Bordas, she got a job teaching here at University of Florida. The book that's just come out is Mount Chicago, which is a novel. It's my third novel, my fourth book. The earlier ones were The Instructions, and then a collection of stories called Hot Pink. And a couple of years ago, a novel called Bubblegum. And I'm very bad, actually, at summarizing any book, especially my own. So I can read the flap copy. It's short and sweet. All right. So this is the flap copy from Mount Chicago. Well, I won't read all of it because then it's... Yeah, I'll read. Okay, yeah, it's true. A 1 in 10 billion natural disaster devastates Chicago. A Jewish comedian, his most devoted fan, and the city's mayor must struggle to move forward while the world quite literally caves beneath their feet. With this polyphonic tale of Chicago-style politics and political correctness, stand-up comedy and Jewish identity, celebrity, drugs, and animal psychology, Levin... And then it says a bunch of nice stuff about me, so I'll skip that. There you go.
You know, that's a great way of summing it up. This is actually a first. I've never had an author be like, I'm just going to read you the flap copy. But you know that you spend time phrasing that summary, you know, and like that's crafted. So might as well share that with the audience.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, that was more of my editor than me. But it's really just that when I start describing my book, I always feel like when I start describing anything that I'm writing, I always feel like I'm betraying it somehow. You know, I just because either I forget something because I'm forgetful, or more likely because I think the real deep down feeling is this sort of artsy fartsy feeling where I'm like, I explain it, the book explains the book, you know, it's just, it's right. some reluctant. So that's, I think that's going to be my move from now on. It's a nice couple sentences. It's quick, you know, so.
And it gives you a good general idea of what's going on here. Obviously, this is a complex book. There's a lot of different things that you're doing. And before we jump into it, I just have to make the addendum that your current location status is kind of the inverse of how I lived my life. So I'm a lifelong Floridian who later moved to Chicago.
Really? Where in Florida are you from? Yeah.
I'm from north of Tampa originally, so one of those Pasco County suburb areas. Tampa Bay, broadly.
I'm terrible with geography, but that's not that far from us. That's between, my parents are now in Sarasota. It's totally weird. My entire family has left Chicago. And my parents are like in Sarasota. And so Tampa is dead center between Gainesville and Sarasota, I believe.
Absolutely. Yeah. I know the area well. I know the University of Florida. And it's weird calling myself a lifelong Floridian. We left when I was about 17. So it's been about 10 years in the Midwest mostly. And I'm thinking, you know, eventually I need to start calling myself a Midwesterner. But until I start liking snow, I don't think I will. Sure. So
Did you go straight to Chicago or where did you land in the Midwest?
So we've always lived in the suburbs. I have lived in the suburbs for a number of years, went to college out in Indiana, lived in New York City a couple years, and then back in the Chicago suburbs where I have put up roots. So here we are.
Right on.
So I know some of the places you're referencing in the book. You know, you mentioned Hammond a couple times, and I'm like, wow, I work in Hammond. Like, I know the area. So, but these are all asides. So, actually the first thing I'm curious about coming to this book. So, you know, it's described as like this polyphonic tale. There's all these characters, there's different ways that you're going with this book. And I want to know kind of what came first to you. Was it the natural disaster? Was it one of these characters, the metafiction aspects, you know, what kind of came first here?
Well, actually, I mean, I guess, you know, I write really sentence to sentence. So it was really the opening was the first thing. So I just thought, you know, I can't really describe, you know, I don't have inspiration. I like work every day and it's not uninspired, but I'm not, you know, there was no like, haha kind of thing. But I think that, you know, part of it was I just started writing in a very different voice from my last novel really deliberately. That's how I kind of approached it. Like, what do I want to figure out how to do, or what do I want to be experiencing as a writer again? When I'm starting out, that's what I'm thinking about. Like, what kind of sentences do I want? And that was, I mean, that's real like wonky and everything, but that's really the truth of it is I thought, you know, I want to write very fast. I want to write short sentences. I want to use fragments and I want a lot of white space. So this is like, all of that is kind of the opposite of my previous novel, Bubblegum, which I'd worked on for 7 years. So I was like, I want to get in a different space now. And so I started doing these like very declarative sentences. And then I think that the idea of the natural disaster and of thinking about the parrot Gogol, they went a little bit together in time. I don't mean, you know, I drew them together thematically or whatever, but the natural disaster was this thought where when I started the book, I think I was 41 or 42, and I'm 45 now, and like what's said in the beginning from the Adam Levin narrator about having never lost anyone that was close to him is actually true. And it's beginning to freak me out a little because I have a lot of friends and a lot of loved ones who do have people that were close to them who died. And the older I get and the sort of more distant I am from this, you know, from any real kind of, well, not distant, but the longer I live without any, you know, sort of epic loss, I just more and more, I'm like, when something happens, this is going to crush me. And I think I started thinking about that quite a lot in, you know, since around that time. And it was just, so it was, you know, it was maybe I was trying to think that through a little bit. And then, you know, a story rose up because that's, you know, personal stuff. The authors, you know, where the stuff comes from, I shouldn't say the author, but me, where the stuff comes from originally is usually just really where it starts. That's like the kind of random set of thoughts that puts things in motion. And then, yeah, from that, like Gladman arose, I was interested in comedy. I've enjoyed comedy, you know, quite a lot in my life. I think most people do to some degree or another, hopefully. And I've tried to write about a comedian before and failed when I was younger. And I was interested in thinking about that again. So I just, you know, generally when I start a book, I can say generally there's only been three novels, but it goes for the stories too, I guess. There's quite a few more of those. Like, when I start a thing, I'm usually kind of seeking out what would sound like kind of a bad idea, like a hard thing to do that I don't know how to do. And then the thrill of it is kind of figuring out how to do it. So, you know, having a novel that's about a comedian who this terrible tragedy happens to, that the terrible tragedy is a natural disaster in Chicago, that you have this sort of ace kid who's not quite a doppelganger for the comedian, but he's a, you know, a sort of different version of him, and that there's going to be a point of view of a bird. All of these things seem like a terrible idea. And so if you were to tell me there's this book that's about these things, I would think that's a terrible idea. But then if you were to tell me I found the book thrilling, I would say, well, I have to read that book because it's when the worst ideas, like the when the worst pitch is succeeds, like as an actual piece, these are the most thrilling books for me. I think almost all the books I love sound stupid when I describe them to myself. You know, Franny and Zooey, I mean, which we'll talk about later, sounds like a terrible book to me. It's one of my favorite books. Do you know what I mean? Does that?
I know what you mean. You're essentially telling me that you approach writing this already incredibly hard thing to do, and you're like, how can I make this harder?
Kinda, yeah. Well, I mean, I think because, yeah, maybe it distracts a little bit from the fact that in the end, it is just me, like, sitting alone in my room trying to grind out sentences that I hope will be entertaining and moving. So if I have this other object toward which to aim, I'm like, and I have to pull this thing off, maybe it like loosens me up or something. Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, that is kind of, that's always how I've done it.
That's very interesting to me. And that makes sense given like how this novel evolves and kind of the directions it goes. Mm-hmm. It makes sense that it kind of took on this piecemeal sort of process for you. Yeah. And coming back to something we mentioned earlier, you know, we were talking about Chicago and that the sense that you have grown up in Chicago and now live away from Chicago. So I'm really interested in the idea of writing about a place when you're no longer there. Speaking from the perspective of a work in progress I'm working on where I'm writing about New York, mm-hmm. having no longer lived in New York. And I'm thinking, you know, to me, there's this sort of double-edged thing of you get a necessary distance, but there's also sort of an impeding distance when it comes to writing about a place that you're no longer in, but are intimately connected to. Was it a struggle at all for you to write about Chicago? Do you feel like that distance from the city helped you write about it?
I mean, I would say it's a boring answer, but I would probably say kind of maybe neither, because I'm trying to think about it. Like, I really think that, you know, for me, like pretty much everything I write is set in Chicago. And it's like, it's a bit of a default mode. Like this book, obviously it's called Mount Chicago. I'm thinking about the place a lot more. And I think that being away from it, I started the book in Chicago. The first, I think almost a year, no, maybe 6 months that I was working on it, we were still in Chicago. And I actually didn't know most of that time that we were going to move. So I think that was definitely not a thought at the time. And then when I came here, it was already largely in motion. And I think that when there were sort of really, when I was really picturing Chicago specific things, you know, I'm not a writer of place, so I'm not sitting there being like, you know, trying to bring across exactly what it is to stand at Damon and Division, right? I'm going to describe one building that is to me part of the narrative. But there was certainly like on an emotional level, just sitting at my desk working on it, I created a lot of very sad longing for the place inside myself. I mean, I really miss Chicago. I love it, you know, there. I don't know. So it was hard in that sense, but I think that if anything, it was a bit thrilling, like to think about in the end, like, you know. Does that answer the question? I feel like I think it does.
I'm always just, you know, fascinated by that idea of, you know, what it means to write about a place when you are there, when you have been there. I think it always takes on a different texture, but you were kind of neither here nor there since you moved kind of in the process. But I think that's really interesting. And so you've mentioned, you know, you're not a writer of place, but this book to me, if there's anything, it's very much a writing of time. This book is very entrenched in a very specific time period, which is very, you know, 2010s, modern day, you know, going into the 2020s. And Apter is who I think of in relation to that. So I'm pretty much exactly Apter's age. So when he is in college, the exact year I was in college. So basically that whole process was very familiar to me. And then being in college during that 2016 election time with all of that discourse. So those chapters did feel very familiar. Mm-hmm. And thinking about that and thinking about kind of the statements you make politically and what you write about politically, does it ever concern you that, you know, when it's so stuck in a specific time that your work might read dated a few years from now? Or is that not something you concern yourself with and just really just try to focus on a time? Is that something that ever crosses your mind?
Well, I mean, with this book, because it's not particularly, I think, a relevant question with the other two books, with the other two novels, because they're, you know, but this one, I think I certainly was thinking about it a bit, but I guess what I ended up concluding, you know, time will tell, but is the sort of, Because I don't think there's really, I don't think of, I'm definitely not, I definitely don't think of myself as a political writer. And the conversations about politics were, these are cultural conversations to my mind. And I think that the way that they're being had in that moment, and I think what, you're probably referring to the stuff going on at the university, right? So it's like the way that the sort of high pitch of everything is, I think it's something that I've been through before. You know, it's something the country goes through every, like, I don't know, 20, 25 years or something, it seems, is that there becomes this sort of this, there becomes a desire to polarize, really. And I think it's, I think it does seem to me to be a bit more extreme now than it once did. But there's, it seems like there's moments, and they probably are tied more to the economic situation of most Americans than anything else. But it seems to me like there's moments when people are going to say some pretty outlandish shit to each other, from both sides, and be pretty much unwilling to want to work together on anything. And so I think that what I see in what I thought about in that scene when it comes to this question you're asking me is that maybe in, like, in a certain moment, what that looks like is it looks like a cartoon. And in other moments, I think it kind of looks like reality. So, and I think that whatever moment you're living in when you read the book, like right now, I think things have calmed a bit from that moment. You'd probably know better because you, like you said, you were in school. Like, but it seems to me that people are trying kind of hard, really, I think since Biden's election, very gradually, but I think there are a lot of folks that are trying to actually figure out how to make things work rather than trying to figure out how to destroy each other. And like that's so I don't know. It's so I guess the short answer is I guess I did kind of think about it. But I don't know that I quite worried about it because it's in the end it's a fairly small part of the book. It's almost really more of a not more of, but it's largely a plot device to, get one of the characters wealthy, and to sort of explore. And I think, I guess I should say, John, I'll keep rambling on about this, but I think that the other thing that happens there, and I don't want to do spoilers, but it's like the way that the character ends up sort of, getting wealthy is by basically exploiting both sides. And I do, if I have a political stance, it's that that's what this is the main problem with everyone trying to kind of kill each other rhetorically all the time is that they're so just ripe to be exploited. Like it's the, you know what I mean? Like, and we saw like it's all this stuff is cliche at this point, like, but it's, you have Pepsi Cola, sending their message and, who, like everyone's going to pick a political thing to back, and they're gonna companies that don't care about LGBTQ community is gonna start putting flags up and like and it's like it's very hard to imagine that anyone actually buys that, but then I wonder maybe like 10-year-olds do, and maybe it's more like it becomes a thing where if you don't put the flag on something you're called a fascist or, you know what I mean? And so and so all in all it totally degrades the meaning of what it is to be part of any of the communities that are purportedly being represented by these symbols put up by, yeah. So I don't know. So and I don't think that's going to go away because I think that's like the most American thing, you know? And it, so does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, that totally puts things into context. And it's definitely the feeling you get from this book, because you're right. It's less political, it's more cultural. It's more speaking to kind of needless division in our conversations and, missing an actual larger point that's being made. And then the other thing I wanted to address in this book, and this may be getting at part of it a little bit for me. And one of the things that struck me most about this book that I really admired is how you write about loss. And you when you talk about a disaster, in a disaster, there is loss and there is grief. And the way you approach writing it to me was really interesting in that it just lacked this like maudlin sentimentality. It was very focused on the literal, on the apathy of said grief. And I'm just, you kind of referenced this earlier, that the precipice of this idea was this idea of, you know, I haven't faced loss yet. What is it going to be like when that happens? Yeah. And sort of building this cataclysmic sort of model. But I'm interesting how you approached writing grief from that very unsentimental standpoint.
Well, I strive to be unsentimental, as all writers do, right? I mean, well, most writers, there's that. There's like probably a whole bunch of, you know, no go areas or whatever that are just, you know, that was fairly simple. But I think that to me it was again, it's hard to talk about without the spoilers, but. I think it would really, like, if I were in that situation, like that Gladman finds himself in, where, you know, and this is not much of a spoiler, it's within 15 pages of the book or something, where it basically, mm-hmm. everyone he loves is killed, except for his parrot. I think that I would be feeling like him, which is, I really wish I could kill myself. Mm-hmm. And I have this responsibility to this thing, though, and that's to this thing being this animal. Right. And that's like, again, you know, this is one of these things that sounds like a terrible idea. If someone told me that, this is a terrible idea, and I think that's, you know, one of the reasons I chased it. But it does seem true to me, because I don't think there's any way to contend with something like that. Like I said, I can't imagine having to contend with the loss of one person that I really care about. The idea that all of them are gone suddenly, is just, I think it's unimaginable. I think any two people who were to experience that couldn't imagine one another's feelings about it, let alone me or anyone else understanding it happening to the one person it happens to. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. It does. And to me, that just put, you know, kind of how Gladman deals with that, and that whole chapter, that to me immediately, you know, I always hesitate to say, do you like characters? Do you get them? Do you relate to them? I feel like all that's irrelevant, but I got Gladman in that moment. And I was just like, this to me felt like one of the most realistic responses to just a tragedy of this scale. And that just made the book, you know, even though there are these absurd moments that feel totally off the wall, that really made it feel like it was grounded in something truly real. And so that definitely resonates.
Thank you.
There's a lot more to this book. Obviously, you know, we could talk at length about all the different things going on in here. I would tell everyone listening, you'll have to pick this book up to truly understand the number of different things going on here. I certainly encourage everyone to check it out. But in the interest of time, I want to move over to talking about this book you chose for the episode. And like a lot of my guests, you know, you expressed, you know, it's hard to pick a favorite book. I have a challenging podcast premise, but it's easy to sort of narrow it down a bit and talk about one. And the one you picked is Franny and Zooey by J.D. Salinger. Yes. And so tell me about when you first read this book and what your overall impressions were.
Well, so I guess I first read it, I'd read Catcher in the Rye, I think like 4 or 5 times. And I never mm-hmm. liked the title Franny and Zooey. And I'd read the stories too. I think what happened was I'd read like Banana Fish. Like, you know, everyone reads that story, A Perfect mm-hmm. Day for Banana Fish. And I hadn't really, and Teddy maybe, but I hadn't really read the rest of that collection. And then I read them and I realized that, you know, I think it was within, while reading this collection, or maybe it was just someone told me that the character in Banana Fish, who, you know, kills himself in the final scene, that this is basically what most of the Salinger work is about. Like, take away Catcher in the Rye, and it's like 95% of the words that he has published are about this family, that the family of origin of this guy, Seymour Glass, who killed himself. And I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. Like, I loved the collection after having read it, and I obviously loved Catcher in the Rye, read and reread it. So I think it was, I want to say like 19 when I read Franny mm-hmm. Zooey, maybe 18. It was one of these things that the voice like instantly spoke to me. It's like, it's so direct. It's so very intimate and warm. And it, mm-hmm. and then there's this metafictional aspect to it, that is real. That's very easygoing, which is to say that similar to how kind of Vonnegut does it, it's or how Roth does it, I guess, in Operation Shylock. Like, you have a guy talking to you. He is this character, Buddy Glass. He sounds quite a lot like J.D. Salinger, whatever. Like, you don't know anything about J.D. Salinger, but you have him telling you from the outset that he's going to describe a scene that happened at his mom's place that he was not in attendance for, that he has only heard phone reports on from three other members of his family, right? Who are the ones who were involved. And this is already like a very challenging, potentially very challenging setup, but also like a really rich one, because now you're reading the report of a brother who's obviously got feelings about his family. And so he is now representing each of them, interacting with one another, and what he thinks of them is coming across. He's imagining what happens, during this incident, which really two incidents, he's imagining what's happening via what they've told him, but also by just picturing things that there's no way they told him. Like, there's no one, any kind of, moment to moment, description of, who lit a cigarette when, or where the eyes of one went to the eyes of another, anything like this, he's not there for. There's no way that his brother, his mother, his sister calls him up and says, "And after mom said this, she gave me a look and she lit a cigarette." No one talks like that. And so you have this guy sort of fictionalizing something that he's claiming is real, which is obviously it's fiction to begin with. It's a novel. And he's self-interested, as all narrators are. And you also learn at the very beginning that he's had some criticism from the members of the family, like minor criticism about it. But they say he represented it fairly well, what went on. And on top of all of that, much of the conversation that is had between these people is about the narrator, and about his role in their lives, and his sort of either fuck ups or successes, depending on how you look at it. So
yeah, that's a great way of conceptualizing, because describing this book, as you mentioned earlier, this is one of the harder books to kind of summarize or encapsulate. It's definitely got this layered aspect of how it's told. There's no such thing as a reliable narrator, but obviously with this book especially, you are getting it filtered through someone who is intimately part of the story but not present for it, and that causes its own biases. And then you have these intense characters that are Franny and Zooey themselves. Yeah. And it's rare for this show. I mean, I've done, 97 episodes, and not often has someone picked a book that I've read before, but this one I had read back in high school. So it had been about maybe 10 years since I had picked it up. I didn't like it in high school. Didn't really like it now, but I definitely see a lot more in it now than I did back then. Yeah. I mean, time and perspective will certainly do that. I've always been a Catcher fan. I've always liked Catcher. Something about this narrative, I mean, I get Franny and Zooey much more than I did back then. I think the thing that strikes me most about this book is the conversation that Zooey has with his mother when he's sitting in the tub and they're having this back and forth conversation. The claustrophobia of that scene is insane. I even though Zooey's being totally cruel and mean to his mother the whole time, I'm like, this scene is so claustrophobic and it is so well rendered. And the whole time you just want mom to get out of the bathroom, and just that level of just tension there, just characterized by that one simple scene, is just so expertly done. And so even though the book, not my cup of tea as a book, there's so many of these like structural elements or just how these scenes are laid out that are just brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting that you call the word you describe is the word you use to describe is claustrophobic. Cause I actually don't find it. I find it like surprisingly not claustrophobic. Like I don't like, which is to say I don't want her to leave. I find like, it's very visualized for me, and the bathroom's too small and it's totally weird. This is this naked adult son sitting in a tub behind a curtain while his mom keeps going on about some pretty intense stuff at certain points. And It actually, like, it somehow seems like completely intimate to me without being creepy. And I'm like, why doesn't this seem creepy? Like, and because it feels very like these people seem like, I think what it is that they all seem like they very much love each other. And that they're, it's, you know, it's also like, it's also a strange thing to think of them living in the same home even. Because of the age, like it's a very different time, right? And everything does seem like every time the medicine cabinet gets open, you're waiting for something to sort of fall out and cut someone or something. But yeah, I mean, I definitely sense Zooey wanting her to go, but there's also something I think what Salinger does, it's pretty kind of magical in there, is every time she almost goes until the, you know, the very end, she comes back, she doesn't go, and Zooey is like in this sort of, he sort of feels bad. He's a very cutting bastard, right? And it's always like, dude, you want to be nice to your mom. And then at certain points, he's extremely nice to his mom. He says the best thing. And he's I don't know, he's an amazing character. I think all three of them are. Like the mother
They
is,
are,
you know, you sort of sense their feelings. There's these complicated feelings. Not in like a, you know, psychoanalytic way, but like there's a lot of complicated feelings between a parent and their child. Like, you know, like weird sudden bursts of guilt or you know, like not shame, but like guilt or anger, like guilt for being angry very suddenly, for being irritated, and then like a kind of desire to like, you know, make up for that, be really kind to them in some way, but then that sends the wrong message, which is annoy me more, something like, you know, and like you're kind of watching this play out in this, in a way that doesn't, it seems like, it seems very not cheap. It seems very real to me. So I love that stuff. And I think that's the, you know, the real thing with the book, that kind of thrills me every time is the sensing of that love between the people, and really more especially between Franny and Zooey, because I think this is the love between a brother and sister. It's not a very commonly represented thing in fiction, and it's like I think it's kind of hard to pull off. And they have, you know, and they have, there's a great setup where they've had this very strange childhood, and so they get to relate to each other over that. They have a brother who committed suicide that is haunting everything. I don't know, they just seem, it seems very much like a family is coming across, and I do like them. I don't know that I'd want to much hang out with them. Maybe Franny, you know, but like she seems pretty cool actually. Zooey seems like he'd be kind of a, you know, hard guy to hang out with, but I like them. Like I really want them to be fine, and I don't even know what it means to be fine when I'm reading the book. You know, I'm just like, oh man, like I don't want you guys to be all upset. You know, like I don't know. It's a strange feeling for me. Because I'm kind of like what you were saying earlier about not really, you know, thinking about likable versus dislikable, or you know, do I care about the characters if they're a real person or not? Like that's not really usually a concern of mine. And in here, it just it's not it, it just overcomes me. I'm just like, I really like these people. Like I want them to be okay. It's a bizarre experience.
No, I think that's very real. And to me in particular, Franny, I found myself, definitely wanting the best for any, if anyone in this book, I wanted the best for Franny. I mean, we're introduced to her from the beginning. And this book is sort of, if you haven't read this book is sort of divided into two. The first section being a date Franny is on with her boyfriend at college. And then after that, Franny and Zooey interacting at the family home, this apartment they live in. And that opening scene Franny has with her boyfriend, I immediately, in that case, it wasn't a claustrophobia for me, but it was just this feeling of, I see what you're saying. You're in this situation where you're trying to find meaning in your day-to-day life and are not finding it. And you're trying to express yourself, and the other person is just not understanding you. And just that lack of fulfillment of that kind of conversation that comes through so well. And you feel her frustration with everything that she says and does. And it's no wonder that she sort of ends up where she is in the second part of it. And you're right that the love between Franny and Zooey definitely comes off. This is a really interesting family to me. I mean, I can see why Salinger kind of explores this family over and over in his fiction. I mean, he's really crafted something really unique and interesting with, you know, their history being on this like wise child radio show. Mm-hmm. There's almost this idea that these were, you know, quote unquote gifted kids now living as, you know, regular adults and trying to, you know, live up to that promise in some extent, but also just try to find some semblance of normalcy. Yeah. And it's, and there's trauma they haven't processed. There's a lot going on here on the surface and not on the surface. And the whole book kind of feels kind of like a stage play mm-hmm. to me, you know, the way this is filtered, you can watch the, it feels like you can watch these conversations going on and someone's going to come in and out of a scene yep. and things like that. It has that very stage play feel to it.
Well, yeah, there's, it's basically, it's like, I was trying to do it in my, cause I read it a few days ago again, you know, for the 10 billionth mm-hmm. time, but I was like, I think it's three set pieces. It might be four, but that's all, that's exactly what it's like. There's a small introduction and then you're in three different rooms, right? Mm-hmm. Like you have Franny at the restaurant, then you have Zooey in the tub with his mom. You have four. And then you have Franny and Zooey in the living room, and then Franny and Zooey on the phone. That's the whole book. Mm-hmm. And it's all conversations. Yeah. And like so what also, I guess that's the other thing that's like that's super cool to me about the book is, you know, Salinger describes a whole bunch of stuff that I remember it creates the worst habits in young writers, actually, like mm-hmm. where it's like he does tell you what someone's doing with their face. He tells you what they're doing with their cigarette. He describes the tone of voice they're using. And like he does all these things that in almost all fiction, when it's done, reads like kind of bad, like overwrought stage direction. And here, again, it's just intimacy. It's like there's something about all of the environments being as clearly built as they are that make it better, more than okay. Like, you know, you have the living room, this overcrowded living room. You have the bathroom, very overcrowded bathroom, you know, full of, you know, not just with people, with objects, but the living room full of, you know, objects. And then the brother's room. And then the mother's room, which is the least described, but you just see Franny laying on a bed on the phone. And Zooey in the brother's room is like, you're like, wow, that's what a strange place for two older brothers to have been. I don't know. It's so vivid that I think I'm just completely happy to go along with it. It's, you know, it's one of these books in Mount Chicago, there's this part, where one of the characters, after he's reading a book that he takes with him everywhere when he travels because it cures his insomnia, because he gets insomnia when he travels. And this is actually like, I get insomnia a lot when I travel. The first night I stay somewhere. And I did figure out a long time ago, like, that Franny and Zooey will do it for me. Like, if I'm like freaking out, you know, it's like I fell asleep. And I don't know if you've ever had insomnia or, you know, but like, I generally don't have insomnia. And like I said, when I travel first night, it's always going to happen. And an hour in, I wake up and everything's terrible, you know? And if I have Franny and Zooey with me, I just start reading it. And then it relaxes me. And like, it feels, it's just this major comfort to be kind of hearing Salinger's voice, I think, and to be seeing these people I'm familiar with. And I always end up picking up stuff that I didn't pick up the time before about the dynamics between these people. I don't know.
Not typically the book I'd think of as a comfort read, but you
yeah,
do you.
Yeah, yeah, no, I know. It is weird to think about, yeah. Except if it's, you know, the way I figure it is, like, first of all, there's that voice. There's the Salinger voice, which I love. But also it is that these rooms are so vivid. And, like, they're warm rooms, you know. And the characters, like you said, you're watching them up close. It feels like I could trust it or something. I don't know. And Salinger's never really cruel. Not in this book. I mean, he's, you know, they're painted very three-dimensionally. So there's, you see the bad sides of all these people, but none of it is, he's never mocking them. Even the mother, it's like, I don't know, like, it's like joshingly making fun of the mother, and you hear the love in it. I don't know. I keep saying love. I sound like a hippie. But yeah, that's yeah. Does it for
it's
me.
Very much the impression that if he makes fun of anyone, the character's perspective, who's, you know, poking the fun, they're going to have that, you know, flip back on to them. There's no character that's sort of the scapegoat here.
Yeah.
You know, every they're all, you know, these flawed figures, and, you know, Salinger, you know, doesn't pull punches with any of them. And in that sense, it felt very much like a family. I mean, that's just how families operate. I mean, the book is, you know, of its time in a few ways. I mean, the spiritualism to me felt, you know, very 50s, you know, it's like discovering the East and what we think about as spirituality. But I think like those, so those parts tended to drag on a little bit for me, the actual meat of their conversations, but just the structures of these scenes and just like the characters that are being sketched out here, those definitely, you know, resonate for sure.
I mean, this spiritualism stuff to me, I think that's certainly when I was young, that spoke to me. And that's the other thing, you know, it's both. And I could say the same thing about Catcher in the Rye. Both of those books, I think I read them, you know, in a way that was opposite how they were intended. So like Catcher in the Rye, you know, it's like a book, a sad book about the biggest phony, right? And then, you know, but the first time you read it, it's a sad book about the only authentic person on earth. And like with Franny and Zooey, somehow, and I still don't really understand how it computed this way. It must have been like whatever I was into at the time, you know, like most, you know, teenage Jewish boys, I start getting into, you know, Buddhism for a couple of years, right? But like I'm reading it and I'm like, this is a really sort of pro-Eastern philosophy, and then, you know, all the stuff that I don't think it is. Like when I've looked at the book since, I'm like, no, this is actually about just how impossible it is to practice religious asceticism in the West, or at least how impossible it is to practice it and still make art. Because that's what it comes to, right? Is like Franny is she wants permission from someone who she has respect for to act, essentially. She wants to be this actress. And Zooey is actually the exact same. It's the same terms, really. But he almost needs to like give himself that, and it does come back to this thing where it's like, well, you know, these ascetic religious folks were amazing and they had all this wisdom. And we actually can't apply it if we do the things that we actually love doing. And he makes this beautiful case. I feel like it's a love letter to artists in a lot of ways. You know, and I always appreciate that too. Like, I think it's, you know, it's like, cause I think a lot of artists do, at least those I talk to, they do have sort of ascetic religious inclinations, not necessarily organized religion, and you know, whatever hemisphere it's from, you know, it depends. But like, I think they start out, and there is a thing where it's like, well, you know, this is very material. This is very much about desire. Like, I want to be the person who wrote this book or who made this painting, and I want it to be beautiful, and I want to be held responsible for that beauty. And that gets in the way of any kind of, you know, really from, you know, religious asceticism, any potential to practice it, because it's completely making art, even though I obviously love it, I think it's a beautiful thing, it's not an egoless activity, right? So it's there's no way for it not to be. This is really kind of beautiful. Well, it's okay though, you know, like I don't know, maybe it's, you know, it's warm comfort rather than cold comfort, the Zooey's line by the end, you know. I
didn't think of it that way. That makes a lot of sense to me, honestly, reading it in context, because the two of them, you know, they want to be artists, and they're, you know, they're feeling that roadblock in their pathway, and it is in, you know, a way to a permission to be egotistical and go out in the world and create if that's what you're called to do. Yeah. And so that definitely makes sense. Yeah. And yeah, for a short book, there's so much to dig in here. Yeah. I mean, like, this book is, you know, under 200 pages, reads in like a day or two. You know, it's very quick, but there's a lot to unpack. And, you know, sort of going along the lines of talking about some books, as I mentioned at the beginning, you know, what are some other books that you'd kind of bring in to the conversation? That's such an overused term, but, you know, other books that you'd bring up as books that you love, maybe in relation to Franny and Zooey in some way.
Well, the first one's going to sound suspect, but it really isn't. I say it's going to sound suspect because my wife wrote it, but it's How to Behave in a Crowd by Camille Bordas, which is about this. It's set in France in sort of more present day times, but it's about this family of genius people, and it's a similar thing where there's this like family that's full of love. They're dealing with a tragedy, and it's this one's narrated by a little boy. But it has this sort of, again, this warmth and intimacy and hilarity. It doesn't have the same shape as Franny and Zooey at all. And it doesn't, I mean, it's, but it was like the first time I read this, and my wife is, she's French, and she published a couple novels in France, which I can't read because I'm a monolingual American moron. But like, she wrote this in English. And so it was the first thing I read by her, and like I was like, my wife is Salingerian. This is amazing. Like, and so, but that it really is. It's one of my favorite books, and I do think that I think it has quite a bit in common with just with sort of Salinger. Like she has some similar concerns. It's sharper, I think. That's not to say Salinger's dull in any way, but there's like it's a lot of laugh out loud, and also like some pretty heavy moving shit too. And again, none of it seeming sentimental. But I'll stop because it's my wife and I know you're doubting everything I say, but it's totally the case. And if you don't believe me, you can read her stories in the New Yorker. She's got a bunch of them in there, and they're great. And then so I would say that, and then as far as like Salinger goes, I actually think I always saw in George Saunders and David Foster Wallace some aspect of Salinger, but it's a little harder to pin down in Saunders than it is in Wallace. In Wallace, it's a lot of times when you're writing about very, when you have very intelligent kids, Salinger comes to mind, and then when there's families, Salinger comes to mind, at least to me. In Saunders, it's not that, because he rarely has those kind of characters. He has, but there's a kind of sweetness, and yet like a willingness to look at some really ugly shit, like all of the writers aforementioned have. And that seems to me, and again, this is, a very personal my journey through literature kind of thing. I didn't study literature, but that looks like there is a path that intersected with Salinger at some point in all of these writers that must have been somewhat important to them at least. And then, I could talk about other books that I love, but relating them to Salinger is a little, I don't know, I'm probably like forgetting three or four that would be more direct to Salinger, but yeah, I don't know. There's yeah, that there's it's that I think what it is, and I thought I'd babble too much, but I think with all these books, what they have in common are these great moments of intimacy and comedy, that are sort of just they commingle like really well. They're braided together in a way that makes things that are not quite real seem very real. Make characters that are a little larger than life sort of seem life-size while being larger than life. Like I don't know, it's a beautiful thing for me
I love that. Yeah, because thinking about everything I've ever read by Salinger, the intimacy is definitely totally there. Those quiet, quote unquote, quiet moments where it's two characters in conversation with each other, or one character just kind of alone in his or her own thoughts. I mean, those speak the loudest in his books, and that definitely is held true with, I haven't read everything he's written, but definitely what I've read, that definitely rings true. And so, before we wrap up today, Adam, can you tell us a little bit about where we can find you and where we can find your work?
Sure. You can find me. I'm not super findable. I'm very not online. I mean, I have a website that's adamlevin.com that has like event updates and stuff. I'm actually coming to Chicago in a few weeks to do a reading with Exile and Bookville, and I think it at Printer's Row. And
Oh,
if
nice.
it's happening, it's unclear. I mean, I shouldn't say that. I have no idea, but I know I'm sorry for that. And the Exile Bookville one, it's being put on by Roosevelt University in Exile, and it's going to be, I don't know if you've been to that bookstore. It's such a great bookstore. It's downtown, and it's in the Fine Arts Building. It's amazing. They have great reading space, but they have a great selection of books. And probably my you know, I don't want to, you know, play favorites too hard, but really probably my all-time favorite bookseller in Chicago is Javier Ramirez. It's his shop. He owns it with Kristen. I can't remember Kristen's last name right now, but this guy has been around and been selling books in Chicago since I think like 1996 or something. And he's just like, this is
Wow.
his shop. It's really cool. He finally has a shop. It opened a couple 3 years ago, I think right after, maybe during COVID or right after COVID. No sense of time. Was that a year ago, 2 years ago? You know, depends when at what after means, right? So I'm doing that. And then if you'd want to see some of my work, like there was an excerpt from Mount Chicago on LitHub, and I have a couple short stories that appeared in the New Yorker in the last couple of years. So you could just search the website. One of them is called Kid Positive. One of them is called A Lot of Things Have Happened. Yeah, I don't know. I got stuff on the internet, you know.
You've got stuff. You've got stuff. And I will let everyone know if you are Googling Adam, do not put an E at the end of his last name or you'll get a bunch of Maroon 5
At
links.
100%, yeah.
I
Yeah, everyone, you know, I mess up his Google so bad, you know. He's always complaining. So I was like, man, it's hard to be less famous than you.
See, I don't have this
Yeah, no, you're
problem.
lucky. Yeah. I mean, you could conceivably publish under just your first name. And like
I probably
no one
would.
would, very few people at least would be interfering with your Google. You know, you have one successful book and you're the amount.
I appreciate that. All right, Adam, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Malviko. It was great talking to you.
And thank you all for listening. As a reminder, we have new episodes every other Thursday. And if you want to follow the show, please do so on Instagram and Twitter at YFB Podcast. And I think those are all my housekeeping details. Oh, please rate and review if you can. Seriously, all the major podcast platforms have a way to give us 5 stars, so it's greatly appreciated if you do. And with that, have fun and happy reading.